Hello, and welcome to another edition of Inquisitive Minds on Brock Radio, CFBU-FM. My name is Mike Saunders, and each week at this time we explore some of the fascinating research being done by Brock University faculty and students, as well as address relevant issues that could impact the Brock community. On today's show, we take a tour of the new BioLink facility operated by the Goodman School of Business in the Cairns Family Health and Bioscience Research Complex. We talk with Brock Community Health Sciences Professor Tony Bogart about his research into the so-called older brother effect and asexuality. And we talk to viticulturalist Jim Woolworth of the Cool Climate Enology and Viticulture Institute about their Vine Alert program. Inquisitive Minds is on the air. We welcome you to this edition of Inquisitive Minds on CFPU-FM. Back in September, we talked with Donald Sear, Dean of the Goodman School of Business at Brock, about the launch of their new BioLink facility, part of the Innovate Niagara Network of Incubators, which aims to join students, researchers, and private sector entrepreneurs to help bring life sciences, biosciences, and other similar concepts to market. Shortly afterwards, I was invited down to tour the new facility, and make no mistake, there is a definite wow factor at play here. I toured the site with BioLink's manager Dan Lynch, and afterwards we sat down to chat about what you'll find in their corner of the Cairns Family Health and Bioscience Research Complex.
Very much so. With BioLink in its location, first of all, as part of Goodman, but located in the Cairns complex, is quite a spectacular opportunity for Brock to show off its capabilities in a state-of-the-art facility and to indicate that we have capability for entrepreneurs working in the science and technology space to bring their new ideas and businesses to commercial reality.
Take us through. We're at the main entrance right now. So what are we seeing when the people come in the door here? What do they face first of all?
Well, we have 4,000 square feet here of combination of private offices, service provider offices, collaborative space, and laboratory facilities that all make part of the BioLink complex. So when we first enter, as you see, we have the Goodman Business Consulting Group that provides business consulting to small businesses. We also have the group of us that are the administrators for this program, the coordinator Cassie Price, myself, and Jeff Chesbrough's office as Director of Incubation and Innovation are the full administration group that operates BioLink. The next stop that we have coming into BioLink is an important part. It's our kitchen area, which always has some coffee available that we use as the foundation for what we call beverage-driven innovation. That's very important for us to make sure that people know that they've got a place to be comfortable in. They can meet some very interesting people with great ideas and opportunities to assist them in a trusted advisory role to help them bring their new products to market. Going down the hallway, we have service provider offices. These are for organizations such as IRAP, the National Research Council's program for small businesses. We have the Ontario Centers of Excellence, the Natural Sciences and Engineering Research Council when they're on campus, and other service providers in the area of IP and venture capital investing, debt financing, and so on. Then what we have coming next is the collaborative space, which is the open environment that we use for student entrepreneurs to assist them in working, particularly in collaboration with other students, particularly trans-faculty type collaborations, where they can produce their new pitches for new ideas. And we're fortunate enough to be on campus here at Brock with two different competitions, one called Blueprint, another one called Monster Pitch, for which the students can provide their new ideas and perhaps get some support and funding for these particular new ventures that they're looking to form. Next, we have the area that gets into the private sector collaborative space. We have private offices available for residents to work on collaborations with Brock. We have conference room facilities available. And then we have both wet and dry lab facilities. These are spaces that are designed, again, for collaboration between researchers, students, and the private sector to work on collaborative projects to develop innovative new products and services, particularly to set up businesses in the Niagara region. We have benchtop availability, benchtop space availability. We have fume hood capability for flammables and toxic materials. We have equipment of a generic nature, such as autoclaves and analytical equipment that they can use. And we also have offices where they can share in the same space collaboration potential between the researchers and the private sector to work together on particular commercial opportunities. Then we also have at the back end, as you can see, we have a design and prototyping area, which includes benchtop space for those new products and opportunities that don't require wet lab, but require some space to plug in their devices. The concept of bring your own devices, it can be in the computer software, it can be in remote monitoring or mathematics, education, business, any of these new concepts for innovation can find a home here as well. We also are very fortunate to have service provider opportunities here, including 3D printing. 3D printing for developing of prototypes of new products and opportunities for researchers and entrepreneurs to be able to show what their new concepts are all about in three dimensions. And we're able to produce these on campus here for our student entrepreneurs, for researchers and new businesses who are looking to see what their new widgets and doodads are all about in three dimensions. And this is part of the services that we can provide, that's part of the prototyping that can be developed here at Brock, at BioLink, for these new products that have commercial opportunity.
There's lots of opportunity for students as well here, from what I can see.
Very much so. We're certainly directed towards the almost 20,000 students that we have here now at Brock, and certain numbers of those will have entrepreneurial ideas. And what we're looking to them to consider is, instead of just looking for a job, why not creating your own job? Taking the opportunity that you may have in the back of your head and saying, well, what if I ran with that? What if I developed this particular product or service opportunity? Is there a potential for me to develop a business for which I can be the director, the manager, the owner of this new opportunity, bringing it to market and hopefully setting up that new business in Niagara region so that we're getting the opportunity to create new jobs here and create new businesses that will set up the long-standing relationship both with Brock and also in Niagara region.
This is a fabulous facility, but I'm wondering, everything you show me seems to be so well planned out. When everything was done and it was completed, did you look at it and say to yourself, I wish I'd thought of that. We forgot about that little aspect. Is there anything at all that maybe in hindsight you might have done differently or added in?
I think we're okay in terms of the sort of the generic base that we have here. But one thing we've certainly discovered is that every product, every idea, every concept is unique. And so we are very open-minded to thinking about how we can do things better with a particular product opportunity, with a particular group of students, for example, and play the what-if game as to how we can perhaps help them succeed with what they're trying to do. Keeping in mind, however, that one of the best ways to succeed is to fail often. And so we are trying to keep a very open mind here with giving opportunities to whatever kind of concepts that people are presenting here. We will see what kind of resources we can provide to them with respect to the mentoring, the advisory, and the facilities to allow them to try it on for size and see if they can make a go of this with our collaborative efforts.
Is there going to be a point where all your tenants are taking up all the space, or is there always available space here?
We are looking at the concept of what I call a space-time matrix. So there's probably always room, either the time or the space availability that we have here, to be able to accommodate new ideas. We also operate very much in the virtual space through the Innovate Niagara Regional Innovation Center and portal that's available to anyone who has new opportunities or new ideas. Check out the Innovate Niagara portal, get connected to us that way, and we'll then decide by discussing it with you whether you actually need to be a resident at BioLink or whether you can actually operate in the virtual space that is also part of what we can provide to you.
So in other words, you could do some of the work here, but you don't necessarily have to do all the work here.
That's correct. And it certainly isn't something that, for example, you don't have to be here 5 days a week for a 3-year project. It might be 2 days a week every couple of weeks in terms of your timing. This is something that we can manage in terms of scheduling and facilities planning. And this is where the idea of that space-time matrix concept comes in. So if you need a bench for some wet lab testing 1 day a week every 2 weeks, 3 weeks, we can accommodate that. At the same time, however, if it is a long-term collaborative project with a Brock researcher and you need 2 years of space in a wet lab environment, we can also look at that for you as well.
So there's no set time frame. It's whatever you need, then BioLink is able to provide them.
Totally open. Certainly the concepts of open innovation along with intellectual property protection are the two balls that you have to be juggling in a concept of innovation like we have here. But yes, we're totally open to consideration of anything from a brief moment in time to a long-standing, long-term relationship with Brock.
Now, in a physical sense, is there room here for expansion of BioLink if need be in the future, or are you confined to what you have right now?
Well, one interesting thing about the Innovate Niagara approach that we have in the region is the fact that we have a multiplicity of incubation location opportunities. So BioLink is looking certainly at the biosciences, the life sciences, applied health type of applications for being the resident in this particular physical location. But we also have the Generator at One through the Innovate Niagara portal, which is the downtown St. Catharines incubation facility for digital media opportunities. And there are other locations around the field of Niagara region where perhaps other incubation opportunities can exist, perhaps in education technology field, in health and wellness, and other regions, advanced manufacturing, for example, that Niagara College is looking to be a major player in. So through the Innovate Niagara model, we're looking at all of these different incubation facilities as being part of the real estate that can be offered to innovators and new idea generators throughout the region.
It's a fabulous facility, and it's impressive to walk around and see what's going on here. For anyone who's listening, how open are you to people discovering more about the BioLink facility? What should they do if they want to find out more about what you're doing here?
We're certainly wide open for tours anytime. If you wanted to just come by the atrium at Cairns Complex, it is obviously better if we know you're coming. But if not, there's typically always someone here that can help you out. Also visit our website at brocku.ca/biolink. And also visit the Innovate Niagara portal website as well. And you'll find a variety of information, good, valuable, solid linkages there that can help you with whatever you've got in mind. We'll be happy to talk to you at any time.
Is this sort of facility the way of the future, do you think, as far as a university is concerned? This is a way to bring new business to Niagara and create new ideas right here at home.
Yes, very much so. There was just a recent article that came out from the Council of Ontario Universities, and they talk about the fantastic opportunities in incubation that is coming across the province, across the country actually as well. But they did highlight some of the various features that BioLink and Brock have brought to the table as well. We think it's a way of the future. The concepts of innovation, commercialization, bringing things to reality, I think is a way of the future. And I think for Niagara region, what we're providing here for the knowledge-based industries is to enhance the potential that Niagara region offers. And really, as I've mentioned before, it's the question of doing this kind of missionary work to spread our word out there to show that Brock, BioLink, and Niagara region have so much to offer from an incubation and then launching perspective that we can set up new opportunities and businesses here in the region for years to come.
As I've taken my tour today, the one thing I've noticed, I hope someone comes along to provide some innovation when it comes to doorstops. That seems to be something wanting here at the BioLink facility.
Yeah, it's one of those interesting things that certainly we have locks and keys keeping things closed when necessary, but when you want to have that door open to show that you are open for business and ready for people to walk in, a good operating doorstop would be something that I would really encourage someone to figure out how to make. The little triangles of wood are great, but it looks like I'd say it's a great innovation opportunity. Come up with a new doorstop.
You heard it here, Niagara. New doorstop. That's what we really need. Dan Lynch, thank you very much for your time today. It's a fascinating facility, and I was thrilled to be able to tour and see what it's all about.
Thanks for taking the time. Anytime you're in the neighborhood, drop in to see us.
And that was Dan Lynch, manager of the BioLink facility at the Cairns Family Health and Bioscience Research Complex, operated by the Goodman School of Business at Brock. If you'd like to take the tour, you can. Just call the office to arrange things. Their extension is 6305. Why are some men gay while others are not? It's an interesting question. but there isn't necessarily an easy answer to it. Filmmaker Bryce Sage, who is himself gay, has been asking the question himself, and he wrote and directed an episode of CBC's long-running science series, The Nature of Things, that aired last week. The episode, entitled Survival of the Fabulous, shows the filmmaker in conversation with several researchers doing work on the gay subject, including Anthony Bogart, Brock University Community Health Sciences professor, whose groundbreaking research includes the so-called older brother effect. Bogart's research stretches back to 1996, when he and colleague Ray Blanchard discovered that, on average, gay men have more older brothers than do heterosexual men. So I asked Professor Bogart to join us in the CFPU studios recently to discuss his research and the episode of The Nature of Things that aired last week. And I asked him where all this began for him.
Well, I've been doing sexual orientation research, so what makes a person gay, what makes a person straight, for about 20 years. It started when I was a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Toronto, and I started working with Ray Blanchard, who was doing some sexual orientation research, and we decided to work on sibling characteristics associated with sexual orientation. And we ended up publishing a study in 1996 that's, I guess, had legs and been well cited in the scientific literature, basically showing that on average gay men have more older brothers than do heterosexual men. And then from there, myself and Ray have conducted additional studies replicating that, and others have in fact replicated it as well. And then in about 2006, I ended up doing a study showing pretty strongly that the older brother effect, on average that gay men have more older brothers, is probably a biological phenomenon. And since that time, we've been investigating basically what mechanism or what process in the womb or genetics is involved with the older brother effect. And so it basically started in 1996 and has continued on since then.
How could the biological aspect be the trigger, if you will, for what happens?
Well, it is an interesting sort of evolutionary puzzle, because if you consider gay genes, how could they have been preserved throughout human evolution? Presumably, people who are heterosexual and carry heterosexual genes should be passed on to future generations, because they end up reproducing more than people who are gay. And therefore, the heterosexual genes should be carried on and not the gay genes. And so that's an interesting conundrum, an interesting puzzle. There's a number of different theories behind it, and one of them has to do with what's called the kin selection theory. And that has to do with this idea that even if you carry a gene for, let's say, same-sex attraction, if that gene, let's say, ends up being expressed in the female relatives of gay people, that particular gene may actually end up making the whole family more fecund, or actually more fertile, and actually produce lots of genes that end up being sent down to future generations. And so there can be ways in which gay genes end up getting preserved and flourish, for example, throughout evolutionary history.
Was that at all a surprise to you, given the research you've done?
You know, that's an important question. It didn't really surprise me. And probably if you ask people about their own impressions of their own sexual orientation, you know, and you ask them, was I straight or was I gay because something that happened to me when I was 14 or 15, most people go, no, you know what? I think this is something that it's been with me all my life, or at least I've had these predispositions to go in one direction or another for ever since I can remember. So in some sense, no, it's not been surprising that some sort of early life prenatal biological factor probably plays some role in people's sexual orientation.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people would have assumed over the years that it could have been something early in their life that suggested to them that's the direction they were going in, rather than it being naturally a biological part of their makeup. That's not necessarily the case.
I think so. I think it depends a little bit on what gender you are, too, in terms of males and females. There's probably more strong evidence that males may have more fixity or less flexibility in terms of their sexual expression, at least in terms of their sexual orientation. Women may have more sort of flexibility and more sort of environmental kinds of experiences that shape and alter their sexuality to some degree. There is some evidence for that. that. But even for women's sexual orientation, there's a fair bit of evidence that there's a biological predisposition that pushes us in one direction or another as well.
I was going to ask about that, whether it would translate to the female gender as well. Is there research being done on that?
There is. There's a fair bit of research being done on it, though, in all honesty, there has been more research on male sexual orientation than there has been on female sexual orientation. But that's been catching up recently, and there's been some really wonderful work by people, for example, here in Canada, like Meredith Chivers at Queen's University and Laurie Brado at University of British Columbia, for example. And also our own lab is, in fact, studying women's sexual orientation. And in fact, if you want to sort of look at the equivalent of the older brother effect in women, we have certainly studied sibling characteristics in women and found no sibling characteristic, be it older brothers or older sisters or younger sisters, for example, that reliably predicts women's sexual orientation. So it's interesting because that particular piece of evidence suggests that women's sexual orientation probably develops differently than men's does.
The program, The Nature of Things, highlighted a lot of the older brother syndrome that we've been talking about, which aired at the end of November. Was that a bit of a surprise when the director and the writer, Bryce, got in touch with you at first?
Yeah, you know, a little bit. You're always sort of surprised when people have a public interest and a media-oriented interest to some degree in some of the work that you do. Although the older brother effect that I've been involved with since the mid-90s has been something that has captured not just scientific attention, but also public attention. So in some sense, it's not that surprising that every month or so, or every week, sometimes I may end up getting a call from various news agencies or television-oriented kinds of programs and asking me to come on or to give an opinion, for example. So in some sense, yes, it's always interesting and surprising to a degree, but in another way, it's not.
For the benefit of those who weren't able to see the program, what was the gist of the conversation between you and Bryce?
Well, Bryce, basically just unpacking what I was expressing to you in terms of the older brother effect. What is it? The fact that it's probably a biological phenomenon. Also, within the context of his personal journey as a gay man, he is very much interested in trying to find out what causes sexual orientation. Why is he different than average heterosexual people, for example? So he comes and talks to me, talks to my colleague Ray Blanchard, comes to Brock, visits our lab, actually has his mother give us a blood sample so we can, in fact, do an analysis on it to see if perhaps 6 months down the road or a year down the road, there's any evidence for our mechanism that we think is underlying the older brother effect. And so that's been interesting, and we'll have to wait and see for really any results that come about because of that. But he also goes to California. He ends up going to Europe, for example, goes to Italy, talks to researchers there, even goes to Samoa and talks to an anthropologist studying people in Samoa. So it's a long journey for him, and it's also done in a very sort of entertaining, campy kind of way. And so it's actually a very good program because it mixes entertainment along with actually pretty good science in terms of explaining some of the explanations behind the so-called biology of sexual orientation.
I wonder if maybe even 10 years ago, certainly 20 years ago, a program like that would not have aired.
Well, I expect not.
Yeah. And the reason I say that is because I suspect there's much less stigma attached to the gay factor, if you will, now, yeah, than there would have been probably even less than a generation ago.
I absolutely agree with that. And also, I think that kudos to Canada. I think that this particular program and the fact that there's money to, in fact, produce a program like this is a reflection on what I consider to be very progressive kinds of values associated with understanding and tolerating sexual minorities. So that's great.
Now, speaking of progressive attitudes, you released your book in August, Understanding Asexuality. You categorize it as a fourth sexuality. For those not familiar, first of all, with the term, what essentially is asexuality?
Yeah, that's a very good question. It's another sexual minority, and it's those individuals who really have no sexual attraction for other people. So they don't have any kind of lust or any kind of drive towards anyone. So they're not interested in males, they're not interested in females. So if you're interested in males, if you're a man, for example, you're gay. If you're interested in females, if you're a man, you're straight. If you're interested in both, then you're bisexual. But if you're interested in neither sex, sexually speaking, then you're asexual. So this is construable as a kind of fourth dimension of sexual orientation, particularly if you consider sexual orientation to be primarily something to do with one's sexual attractions, who you are attracted to. And so asexuality has been relatively understudied, and this particular book takes the science behind asexuality, kind of tries to examine it in the best way that we can. It also tries to look at sexuality from an asexual's point of view. And so we end up seeing sexuality for a very different perspective, because if you kind of remove yourself from the very sexualized society that we live in, you can actually take a very interesting view and understand better, to some degree, what sexuality is and just how interesting and kind of crazy it is sometimes.
So, to be clear, they may not be sexually attracted to someone, but they can be attracted to them in the overall sense.
That's correct.
And they can have a perfectly happy and fulfilling relationship if that's the level they choose to have it on.
That's correct. So the way I describe it is that asexual people can have romantic attraction for others, and so they can have love bonds and certainly form friendships and strong friendships with others, but they don't necessarily have any kind of real sexual connection to other people. And so they may be even in married relationships, they may even have children and may actually function sexually, at least behaviorally, but they still don't have any sexual attraction for other people. But many of the asexual people that have been studied are oftentimes single individuals, but not all of them.
So they could enjoy the romance.
Yes.
Not necessarily the sexual encounter itself.
That's right. And so they may have things like affection for another person, cuddling, and other kinds of romantic kinds of activities that they engage in. But they wouldn't necessarily be interested in any kind of sexual connection. That's not to say that some may not engage in some sexual behavior sometimes to please a partner, for example, but they don't have any kind of sexual connection to other people. And that's basically the definition of asexuality.
And I can imagine if they do have a partner, the other partner would be probably initially very worried about the relationship. The dialogue would be very important between the two of them to understand where this asexual relationship is. They're going to feel that it's them. Is it me?
Right.
Am I at fault here?
Yeah, and it is certainly the case that asexual people in romantic relationships oftentimes have struggles and issues with regard to their partner expecting them perhaps to engage in sexual behavior, and the asexual person doesn't really want to do that, and so on. So there is oftentimes some conflict and tension. And so if asexual people are in a romantic relationship, oftentimes they have to, in some sense, express and communicate pretty deeply about their own lack of sexual interest to their partner. And there may be some conflict there. But some asexual people actually end up pair bonding and having romantic relationships with other asexual people. And then they end up just having romantic relationships with others. Or it may be the case that they're in a relationship with a sexual person, but ultimately the relationship becomes relatively non-sexual, and the sexual partner just accepts that this is the way their partner is, and that partner who is sexual may go elsewhere to express their sexuality, but not within necessarily the confines of the relationship itself.
And obviously then the dialogue would be important to be able to understand where each partner is.
Absolutely.
And where they want to be in that relationship.
That's right, absolutely.
Would there be a problem as far as the asexual person is concerned, not understanding themselves, what it is they're feeling?
Oh, absolutely. That's another kind of interesting question. Because asexuality has been under the radar in society, people probably don't even have a label for themselves. They kind of know that they're different, maybe, than other people. And sort of in high school, everybody is trying the dating thing and are really interested, and hormones are raging and all that kind of stuff, and they're interested interested in perhaps having sex with the opposite sex or the same sex. And they may know they're different, but they may not have a label for what they are. And so in the last probably 5 years or so, in part because of some of the research I did, but also because of a website associated with asexuality, the message is starting to get across that this is a kind of different minority. And people are starting to understand that this is a kind of minority that hasn't been expressed or at least not been identified before. And once they start realizing a little bit of the research out there and that there's other people like them, they may start to have some sense of themselves, may develop an identity as an asexual person, and may even self-identify as an asexual person.
Do we have any figures as to how many people in society are feeling asexual?
I did a study in 2004 that had a lot of media play, and that particular study examined a national sample in Britain. And I didn't conduct the study itself, but what I did do is I reanalyzed this data. It was a very well-conducted study in Britain. And 1% of that particular group in that national sample indicated that they felt no sexual attraction and, in fact, had never felt sexual attraction for other people. Since that time, I've reviewed a number of other studies with similar data, similar surveys, and so on. And in between about 0.5% and about 2%, this particular level seems to be somewhat consistent within the context of a number of different studies. So I would suggest that the 1% figure, at least right now, is a good working figure, but it may be lower than that, it may be higher than that, and it certainly depends on the time period that you're surveying. Also, it depends on the country of origin and so on. But I think 1% is a good ballpark working figure. And so in my book, for example, I suggest that as a figure that's probably interesting and worthwhile to consider as the population figure.
So I would imagine that the numbers could be skewed somewhat by the fact that people would refuse to accept themselves, that that is their sexual preference.
I think so. Because it's under the radar, there's probably a number of people who don't end up identifying and don't end up expressing that they are, in fact, asexual. They may, in fact, use their own romantic attachments to kind of indicate that, you know what, I'm gay or I'm straight and so on, and therefore they wouldn't necessarily say that they're asexual. And so there may be a kind of underrepresentation of asexual people for that particular reason. There's also differences in terms of some people who aren't sexual yet in society. So, for example, young people may have a formative experience that makes them sexual later on. And so in some sense, I don't want to give the impression that everybody who right now identifies as asexual would in fact identify as asexual for the rest of their life. But there's probably a core group of people who have never felt sexual attraction and probably will never feel sexual attraction throughout their lives.
Can this apply to both male and female?
Yeah, it can. In fact, there's similar figures for both males and females in terms of asexuality. There's a slight higher percentage for women versus men. And that was what I found in the original 2004 study and also a follow-up study. And other researchers have confirmed that that, in fact, is probably the case, that there is a slight gender difference there.
Do you think asexuals in society today would be marginalized, much like homosexuals would have been marginalized a generation or so ago?
I absolutely think so, yeah. And in fact, in one of my book chapters, I talk about the identity formation issue with regard to asexuality and also within the context of sexual minorities. And I also talk about the fact that society probably marginalizes and has prejudice against all sexual minorities. And there may be even a stronger kind of marginalization towards asexual people. In fact, there's actually some very good research done by people at Brock in the psych department, Gordon Hodson and his student, for example, who ended up doing a very interesting study showing that asexual people may be perceived as less than human by other individuals and, in fact, may be more marginalized than other sexual minorities.
Yeah, I was just going to mention the fact that obviously some people would consider them, hate to say it, but weird.
Yeah.
That takes us back to a homosexual person a generation ago would have been viewed the same way. It just wasn't normal.
Sure.
Which is wrong.
Sure. And in fact, again, reiterate that being open, being progressive, and being sensitive to sexual minorities is a good thing, and my kudos to Canada for being sort of on the forefront of that, at least to some degree.
Now, as far as the program, The Nature of Things, is concerned, which aired at the end of November, what do you think may come out of people watching the program? For you yourself, do you think that it will bring to light some of the work you've been doing more so than already?
Yeah, I think so. I think it will end up showcasing Brock, and that's great. It will end up showcasing some of the work that I do and some of the work that my lab team does, who do wonderful work along with the work that I do, and so that's great. It also helps within the context of us recruiting participants for studies sometimes. So if anyone is interested, for example, in being involved in a research study related to sexual orientation, so for example, if gay men and mothers of gay men are interested in participating in a study like what we're doing, they can always give us a call. And this particular program showcases the kind of work that we do. Also within the context of asexual people, if there's asexual people who are interested in being part of studies that we do, they can always contact us. And that is also a positive benefit from a research standpoint to putting the word out, so to speak.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, they hear about research being done and they wonder how, if it interests them and probably impacts them directly for whatever reason, how can I get in touch?
Yeah.
How can I do that? So how would people get in hold of you?
They can email me. They can phone me at Brock. You know, they can just look up my name at the Brock directory and then leave a message on my answering machine or email me. It's tbogart@brocku.ca. And so happy to have an email from anyone who's interested in participating in the kind of work that we do. So that'd be great.
Anthony, we thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you very much.
And that was Professor Tony Bogart, a Brock Community Health Sciences Research and Professor, on his groundbreaking research into asexuality and the so-called older brother effect. When it comes to winter in Niagara, cold hardiness is an asset that applies to people as well as our celebrated vineyards. With the help of Brock University's Vine Alert program, operated by the Cool Climate Oenology and Viticulture Institute, Niagara's grape growers can better prepare for winter's worst blast. Vine Alert is now in its fifth year of helping growers in Ontario's key grape-producing regions produce sensitive varieties that are most at risk from the cold weather. If over the course of the winter, the cold hardiness monitoring shows a potential damaging event, the alert system will warn growers to the problem, who then can head into the vineyard after the event to test the grapevine bud survival. CCOVI, or CUVI, viticulturalist Jim Woolworth visited our studios recently to talk about the Vine Alert program, and I asked where the idea for the program came from in the first place.
Well, the Vine Alert program started in fall of 2010, and it came to be because of the industry, really, and the threat of winter injury and how it impacted the economics of the local grape and wine industry. We've had a number of cold winters over the past couple decades, and it has resulted in loss of vines and therefore loss of crop and loss of income for the farmers and for the wineries. And so there needed to be something in place to help protect the grapevines and help the growers in the local industry mitigate this threat of winter injury. And so the program came to be from the industry really approaching the university and other researchers and consultants in the local industry here, or local community, to help them deal with this problem. And so methods were developed through our resources to be able to analyze cold hardiness in grapevines. And then I was hired as a research scientist at Brock University to do both research and outreach for the industry. And one of my mandates was to help create this program called Vine Alert to help the industry mitigate winter injury.
So how does the program work then?
So the program works where it's a web-based cold hardiness database. And what we actually do, myself and research associate Dr. Kevin Kerr from Kerr Crop Management Services, he's part of the Cool Climatology Viticulture Institute, and our teams will go out to vineyards across Ontario and actually sample the vines throughout the dormant period and actually test how cold hardy they are. We'll be able to accurately measure how winter hardy the vines are at any given time. This information is then relayed seamlessly through a web-based database, and growers can access that information. Anyone can access the information.
I was going to ask about that because the information would be of great use to the growers, but could anyone, for example, could myself log on, find out the information myself?
Yes, the information is available free to everybody. So anyone, whether you're a grower, a researcher, an amateur winemaker, a professional winemaker, anyone could get this information. We have people viewing the data from many countries all over the world. It's not just the local Ontario industry, but people all across Canada, whether from the Maritimes to BC and everywhere in between, are looking at this information. So it's had quite a reach in terms of who the information is getting to.
Well, so what benefit would it be to someone, for example, in another country? Because it wouldn't directly apply to them because their climate would be different from what we have here. But what information could they glean from that would help them?
Some of the information that they're looking for likely are, people are always curious of what's happening in other regions. So people in, let's say, BC, for example, are looking at, okay, we're growing these varieties too. At this time of year, how cold hardy are they in Ontario? Because that might give us some kind of idea of how cold hardy things are where we are. The other thing is people are looking for information on just general cold hardiness of different varieties. We are testing Vitis vinifera varieties. So these are your noble wine grapes, which are very winter sensitive. And since our industry has progressed to these types of quality vines and quality wine, they're more susceptible to winter injury. So people who are interested in planting more of these varieties in cooler climate areas or colder climate areas are interested to see how they're performing in a cooler area like ours that have Canadian winters. And so they're able to see how cold hardy and how they respond to the climate conditions. So there's a lot of information available through the Vine Alert program. We're sampling over 7 varieties across many, many appellations and sub-appellations. So we are covering from Southwest Ontario to the Niagara Peninsula to Prince Edward County. And so there's a lot of information being gathered here, both variety specific, but also regionally specific as well.
So the information you're gathering is Ontario specific, but the information that you draw from it can be used in many other parts of the country and indeed the world.
Yes, it is very site specific and regional specific to Ontario, and we want it to be that way so our industry is getting the best data they can possibly have. But the information can be related to other areas. You can transpose some information from that.
Would you be able to take the program and adapt the program itself to another area of the country, for example, in BC or another country, another wine-growing region in the country?
Yes, it would just be a matter of really just changing the input of the data and just importing that regionally specific data as opposed to what we're doing.
Now, I gather the main advantage for the growers using the program is it allows them to be more proactive than reactive as far as what they're growing is concerned, and I think that would be a big plus for them.
Exactly. So the program actually is proactive in the sense that we are testing and predicting the cold hardiness of different grapevines from different areas at any given time. Now, this information is really important now that our industry is using a lot of wind machines to protect the vines. Now, after the cold freezes of 2003, 2005 in particular, the industry really moved from having no ways of protecting grapevines and mitigating the impact of those damaging temperatures. But then after those years, more and more people started putting up these wind machines. And Chateau de Charmes, Paul Boss Sr. was one of the first ones to have these wind machines. And when people started seeing some of the effects of using these types of wind machines or helicopters and so on, they realized, wow, you can actually make a difference and mitigate those cold temperatures and help save the vines.
So would the Vine Alert program then mean that they wouldn't necessarily have to employ those practices? Because, I mean, bringing a helicopter in is not an easy prospect, nor a cheap prospect.
Yeah.
So obviously, if you have to do it, you have to do it. But if this gives you the opportunity to prepare and work around that, ultimately, that's going to save you some money as a grower.
Exactly. And so because it was also a guessing game before when to turn on these wind machines or when to call in helicopters, we did not know, and the industry did not know specifically how cold hardy the vines were. And it changes from growing season to growing season based on different factors in the vineyard, different environmental factors, and depending on what you do in the vineyard can impact the cold hardiness. So it was really a guessing game. And so there was a lot of wind machine use that may not have been needed, because the vines may have been more cold-hardy than they had thought, or in the other case, the vines may have not been as cold-hardy as they had thought, and then there was a winter injury event, which you thought you missed, but it actually had occurred. So through this testing, we're able to basically allow the growers in the wineries to really dial in their wind machines so that they're set to the appropriate temperatures, and different varieties may be more sensitive than other ones. So by testing a lot of different varieties, from the very cold, tender varieties to the more cold-hardy vinifera varieties, we're able to give the grower community really site-specific and relevant information to them so they know exactly when to turn on these machines. As you know, they're quite loud. They do sound like a helicopter. And with a lot of, if you want to call it urban sprawl or what have you, where a lot of homes are going closer and closer to vineyards, the communities had some issues before with noise complaints. These machines are typically run in the dead of the night or first thing in the morning when temperatures start to plummet. And so these do create a lot of noise, especially in Niagara Lake now, there's hundreds of them. If they're all running at once, it's not going to be a quiet night's sleep. But if they're there to protect the vineyards, to keep our industry sustainable, people aren't going to have a problem. And our data helps support their decision to run these machines. So we're really working, Brock and Covey are really working with the community to help have a sustainable industry here.
It would be viewed, I would imagine, as a necessary evil, the wind machines. You just have to do it.
You just have to do it. And since we've had these wind machines and we've started the Vine Alert program, we really have allowed to grow the varieties that we really want to grow, which are varieties like Chardonnay, like Riesling, Pinot Noir. We're making world-class wines out of these varieties. But our cold winters can influence the quality by either not having a crop or having vines that are unhealthy or vines that are out of balance. And all of these things come into play in terms of if you want to have a sustainable and quality wine industry. And it all really starts at the beginning of the year, but you have to get through that winter period. And so this is where the Vine Alert program and the use of wind machines, for example, have really changed our industry and helped move our industry forward. I would say now almost wind machines, if you're growing these types of varieties, are basically a standard practice almost now.
The different varieties of grapes being grown, people may not be aware that some would be more cold hardy than others. So what would be the most cold hardiest, if you will, variety for growers?
Well, there's a lot of variation in terms of the cold hardiness of different varieties. Now, we grow vinifera varieties, which are the most cold sensitive, but we also have some hybrid varieties like Vidal Blanc, for example, and Bacal Noir. Now, those are much more cold hardy, and they, in general, don't need as much protection or any protection, especially in the Niagara Peninsula, where you do have the escarpment and the lake influence. But in terms of the vinifera varieties, some of our most cold-sensitive ones are varieties like Merlot, Sauvignon Blanc, and Syrah. Those are some of the more winter-tender ones that we test. There's also other varieties that are also very, very cold-sensitive, but we generally don't grow too many of them, and if we do, they're only in little pockets. In terms of some of the more cold-hardy vinifera that we grow, Riesling is generally more cold-hardy. If you think of where it's grown in Germany, it's a cooler area, for example, and just where it's evolved. And Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, Cabernet Franc, those are some of our more cold-hardy vinifera varieties. But again, depending on what the grower does in the vineyard, let's say if you put too much crop on the vines, if they're neglected and there's some disease, these little types of things will all influence how cold-hearted they are. Just like us as humans, if we're stressed at all, if our health is compromised, we won't get through the cold season either in terms of viruses and so on. We will get sick. And so the vines are similar in that way, where different stresses can influence the cold-heartedness of them. So it can be site-specific and it can be grower-specific or regional-specific as well. And so this is part of our research program that we're doing at Brock as well, is looking at what factors influence cold hardiness so that the grower community can optimize cold hardiness in all of the cold sensitive varieties that we grow. So we're looking at things such as crop levels for different varieties. We're looking at the impact of timing of harvest. We have a sparkling industry where we're picking very early, all the way to an ice wine industry, which is really our benchmark, our number one export product that people recognize us for. But what kind of impact are we having on the vines by leaving those crops, which are generally heavier, late in the season? So, for example, yes, some ice wine was picked this past week, but there's also a lot of ice wine still hanging out there that may not be picked till December, January, February.
This week would have been very early. Most years, to harvest the ice wine grapes, usually we're expecting it end of December, early January.
Exactly. So a lot of times it's over the Christmas holidays, and this year was very early. I don't think it was the earliest on record, but having a harvest in November for us is, in Ontario, is quite early. BC, they have these cold snaps, late fall, winter period, like early winter period, whereas we generally are a little bit later when we do harvest ice wine. The ice wine already, they're a happy bunch because they don't have to worry about picking ice wine over Christmas.
That's a real Christmas present in itself, I would think. The dormant period for the vines, which is basically from the fall, once the harvest is in, till the spring, the growing season begins again. So you've got this basically, for want of a better expression, a dip. Is there any time in that period, that dormancy, where they are more cold hardy or less cold hardy? Or is it consistent over that dormant period? The cold hardiness, whatever it is, that's what it is.
Yes, that's a very good question. Cold hardiness of the vine changes throughout the whole period. And there's three distinct periods of cold hardiness dynamics, if you want to call it that. The first stage is acclimation. And this is when the vines are going from a cold sensitive period to a more cold hardy period. So the vines are acclimating to the cold. And this actually starts, believe it or not, when the leaves are still on the vines and there's still fruit on the vines and so on. So this is happening in August already. And the vines are getting ready for winter. They get periderm formation on the canes, for example, and start getting some browning, some bark formation onto the canes, the new growth, the one-year-old growth. And this is really a visual cue of when the vines are starting to harden off, is what we call it. So that's the first period, is the acclimation period. And this is during from late summer to the fall, early winter. Like, we're still right now into the acclimation phase. Midwinter, when we're at the coldest months, we're at what we call maximum hardiness. And this is when the grapes reach their maximum, their genetic potential for that given year, for example. After that period of time, we have the period called deacclimation. And this happens later in the winter when we start getting warmer temperatures. The vines are held at that period of time under dormancy just by temperature. It's temperature-induced dormancy. And so through warmer weather, the vines will start to lose their cold hardiness and becoming more and more cold sensitive. And the reason for this is they're getting ready to start the next year's growth. So they have to deacclimate so that they're able to break bud and produce the next year's growth and next year's crop. So during all three of those periods, there could be winter injury. And that's why we have to continue to test cold hardiness throughout dormancy. If we would just say, take a snapshot right now, take a snapshot in midwinter, we will not have an accurate estimate of cold hardiness. And so we have to test cold hardiness constantly throughout the dormant period. So we're testing all the time. We're running through our original cold hardiness program. We're testing 100,000 buds during this period. So we're testing hundreds of thousands of buds through one season, I should say. So we have a lot of information that we're gathering to make sure that we're tracking cold hardiness throughout all of these critical periods. Now, if we have a cold snap at any one of these times, we could be in trouble, especially following a warmer period, let's say in deacclimation period. So March 2012 was a perfect example of what happened when we have warming periods and very unseasonable temperatures, especially warm temperatures, during this critical period of cold hardiness, followed by cold temperatures again. So in March 2012, we had temperatures over 20 degrees Celsius. The vines were deacclimating, the apple trees, the peach trees, and so on. Everything was coming out of dormancy very quickly. We were testing, obviously, during that time, and in a matter of a week, we lost 15 degrees of cold hardiness in grapes. So the grapes went from being hardy to close to negative 20 degrees Celsius to negative 5 degrees Celsius in a couple of weeks. This was followed by temperatures of negative 6 at the end of March, April, and we immediately sent out alerts through Vine Alert. It's another one of our features that we have where we're able to send out mass alerts to the industry. We also work with the local community and the Grape Growers of Ontario, for example, and they will send out an alert to all of their growers. So 600 growers over Ontario will get this message saying how the vines are responding to these changes in climate and what to do to help mitigate these potential damaging temperatures that may happen.
What about the snow cover? If we get a winter, and we've had many of them where we don't get a huge amount of snow cover, that will play a role as well, as opposed to a heavy snowfall winter, which I would presume would help to insulate the area around the vines.
Yes. So snow is an amazing insulator. It works very, very well when it's there. So you can use snow as a way to protect vineyards and vines, but that snow is transient. It's not going to be there at all times. And so you may have the snow around the vine, and if we have a damaging cold snap, the area of the vine underneath the snow may be safe, but most of the vine will not be. I've done some testing in the vineyards, and yes, the vines are generally have better bud survival underneath snow cover, but at the same time, because those buds are not exposed to as cold of temperatures, they will actually be less cold hardy. So if that snow is removed, those areas of the vine that were underneath that snow would be more susceptible to damage than those that were just exposed to the ambient air temperatures throughout the whole winter period. And so I've actually had a couple of research projects looking at different ways of protecting vines. One of them is using geotextile materials, so these felt-like materials, and using it as an alternative to actually burying the vines, because in some regions we're burying grapevines with soil. And again, when you do that, you are changing the dynamics and the environmental conditions around the vine itself, and that can have an influence on both cold hardiness as well as survival.
So what part of the vine, generally speaking, would be most susceptible to the cold? Would it be the part that's closest to the ground or up there facing the elements where you can't really do a heck of a lot to insulate it? Mm-hmm. You can do some, but you can't do everything.
All the parts of the vine are susceptible, but at different times of the year, there is some variation in terms of which one is the most susceptible. Generally, what we're testing is we're testing the buds. The primary buds are what will produce the fruit for that growing season. So what we're testing is the actual bud tissue itself. But you can have damage in the buds, in the cane tissue, in the trunks, and well, you can't have it in the roots as well, but that's less common. Now, what growers do here, and this is standard practice really in Ontario, but other regions as well, is if you'll see right now in the vineyards, they will have a hill of soil around the graft union. So the graft union in the trunk can be very susceptible, especially in a younger vine. And so this was done again back from some of the pioneers in our industry, is they would come and hill up around the graft union. So that helps protect the part of the trunk. But it depends on the time of year. The vines can sustain damage anywhere. So it can be the trunk, it can be the buds, it could be the cane tissue. And so we do a lot of what we call spare parts viticulture here, where we will have extra trunks, extra canes, and leave extra buds so that we can always remove them, but we have those spare parts in case they're needed, in case there is some damage that occurs. So we can compensate for that. So the other aspect of Vine Alert that we actually do, and this is more, we have the proactive aspect where we're predicting the cold hardiness so growers know when to turn on their wind machines. The other aspect of Vine Alert is that reactive part where we actually test bud survival as well. So we actually look at what percentage of the primary buds that are still alive after potential cold and damaging event. And so with this information, it can be very variety specific. A very tender variety such as Merlot may have 60% damage or 40% damage compared to Riesling, which may only have 10% damage. In that case, the grower can adjust how they're going to prune the vine, for example, or what they will do prior to the growing season so that they can compensate for some of this loss. So it may just mean leaving extra bud numbers on the vine so that you can come back in the season with a yield that's generally 100%, or try to mitigate so your losses are less. That's the other aspect that we have for Vine Alert, is the bud survival part.
Generally speaking, in that dormant period, would it be better to have a very cold winter with a lot of snow, or would it be better to have a more moderate temperature over the course of that dormancy period, maybe not so much snow cover? What is the ideal scenario, in other words, for that dormancy period?
That's a good question. In terms of what we don't want to see are a lot of peaks and valleys. What we don't want to see are temperatures of unseasonably warm periods followed by very sharp drops in temperature to low negative 20s, for example, or to the negative 20. That's the thing we don't want to see, is like these big fluctuations in temperatures. It's nice when you do have a colder winter with snow cover, as long as we don't get to a lot of temperatures below negative 15, for example, then we'd be fine in that scenario. If the warmer temperatures are fine, if you think of California, for example, they don't have very cold dormant periods. And the vines, they won't get as cold hardy as they do here, but they don't need to because they don't get those temperatures that we have in the winter of below negative 15, negative 20, and so on. So it's really a balancing act, and we don't want to see the extremes either way. That's the best answer I can give.
It's always a balancing act over the dormant period and in the growing season in the summer. Temperatures play such a big role. And I can see where your program is at least going to help over the winter months. It's a brilliant idea. It's a great idea. And we thank you very much for coming in, Jim, to tell us about it today.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
And that was Brock Cool Climate Enology and Viticulture Institute viticulturalist Jim Woolworth on the innovative Vine Alert program they've developed at Brock. That's it for this edition of Inquisitive Minds on CFBU-FM 103.7 in St. Catharines. My name is Mike Saunders. I hope you've enjoyed the program. You can contact me via email at any time at talk@cfbu.ca with show comments and suggestions.
Until next week, always remember to have an inquisitive mind.